Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 63 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarvox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Every 2 weeks, we come to your earbuds with discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology to hopefully improve your life, since you don't have to look at journal articles, maybe, and you then can help your patients without having to have scrolled through a bunch of email digests. So that's our goal. Hopefully we're doing a good job. And before we get started with the discussions today, I wanted to tell you guys that we've got a fun video that we're going to put up on the website. So back in episode 49, we talked with guest Dr. Beth Morell, who's a lichen sclerosis expert. And she told us that the Lichen Sclerosis Society out where she lives in like the Netherlands has made a card game about lichen sclerosis, and that they were going to send us some copies of it. And yay and behold, they finally made the transatlantic journey to my house in Salt Lake City. So Ryan Carlisle, medical student and member of Team Germosphere, who also runs our social media, kindly videoed me doing an unboxing video. An unboxing video is when you watch somebody open a box. It's more exciting than it sounds. And a lot of other fun games came in there too. So it's like 3 or 4 minutes, I think. We'll put it up on our website, and I'll probably release the audio as a bonus episode in like a week, even though it's only 3 or 4 minutes, just to, you know, remind people that it's out there. So take a look. It's pretty fun, and the games are pretty fun too. All right, let's get into it. So Michelle,
yes.
Not too long ago, you and I were guest speakers at the Intermountain Dermatology Society.
It was lovely.
Which was lovely. Yes, in beautiful, sunny our closets, because, of course, like everything else, it has gone virtual. But it's supposed to be in Sun Valley, Idaho. Maybe one day we'll get out there again. And we discussed some questions from our maintenance of certification portion of the meeting. And it would be nice, actually, if we release that as a bonus episode, if I can get my hands in the audio and if everything's kosher with copyright and so on, maybe we'll release that one too. Anywho, you talked about a condition I had never heard of called Bascule syndrome.
I did.
Bascule. And I believe your exact quote was, "It's so hot right now."
So hot.
And then I felt embarrassed because I had never heard of it before. So I aim to change that for myself and for any of our listeners who also are like, Bascule syndrome, hot right now, Mogato, what are you talking about? So this is out of pediatric dermatology, and the article is entitled Beer Anemic Spots, Cyanosis, and Urticaria-like Eruption. So that's what the acronym Bascule stands for. Once again, Beer Anemic Spots, Cyanosis, and Urticaria-like Eruption syndrome, report of 2 new cases and literature review. And the authors are out of Belgium and include Pamela Nemnon and Valerie de Coulinier. And Bascule syndrome was described in 2016, so just 5 years ago. And with these 2 cases in this article, there are now apparently 9 reported cases. It's probably underrecognized. You'll see why as we get into it. So my guess is that we're going to see lots and lots more being described. It's thought to be a benign cutaneous / vasomotor condition, though 3 cases have been associated with orthostatic intolerance, which has not been quite so benign. You know, people stand up and their blood pressure drops and then they feel lightheaded or even pass out. That's no bueno. So both of the reported cases in this article were 13-year-olds. There was one boy and one girl. In total in the literature, 2 of the 9 cases were newborns and the other 7 were all in adolescents. Kind of interesting. So the signs and symptoms of Bascule syndrome always appear when standing, though sometimes the standing can be in particular ways that you might be standing or other ways of being upright. So it might not be clear that, oh, this is because you're standing or you're upright, because the patients might say it only happens when they're in a pool, but it's just specifically standing in a pool, which was the case in one of these patients, or while showering or walking. So again, it might be a little bit difficult to tease out that, oh, while you're walking, you're upright. So it's not really the walking, it's the fact that you're upright. And usually the signs and symptoms appear within 1 to 2 minutes. and they're usually on the lower limbs, though there was only one, there was one of the nine reports on the trunk and extremities. And what you get are beer spots that develop into urticarial wheals. So beer spots, B-I-E-R, are these vasospastic macules, is the other name for them. I guess Dr. Beer must have been the person to first describe them, and boy, he sounds like a partier, right? Not the same beer as in Beer's List, I'm 90% sure. So beer spots are really benign, very common things. I think, Michelle, you might even get them. Did you show them off to us once upon a time?
I think I do sometimes. I'll see if I can get them to show up.
Yes, for our listeners. So,
yeah, so they can hear them over the podcast.
So it seems to be more common in women. Like if their arms are just dangling at their side, sometimes these little pale spots will show up. But then when you lift your arms up, they go away. So they're just thought to be associated with vasospasm. But in these bascule syndrome, you get those mostly on the legs. And then you get those little pale spots. And then they turn into kind of urticaria. And they resolve when you're lying down. You can also get cyanosis in the same areas. So remember, that's like blue-looking cold kind of extremities. And both of the patients reported in this article had those things. So when standing in a pool or showering or whatever, they got some cyanosis. They got these pale spots that turned into kind of urticaria things, and they laid down and they went away. These patients also had some pain and pruritus, which seems like it's fairly common in the few reported cases. People have at least some kind of discomfort. A lot of patients have been biopsied, but sadly for our dermatopathologists out there, it seems like it's pretty nonspecific. If you get one of the urticarial lesions, it just kind of looks a bit like urticaria. Stop me if I'm speaking out of turn, Michelle. You're the dermatopathologist here.
You're right. Sometimes these things are underwhelming under the microscope.
So, you know, this stuff that's weird and shows up when you're standing, goes away when you're lying down, it's itchy, it's painful, so you want to do more workup, probably. So most of the patients reported have undergone cardiac and rheumatologic evaluation, which was the case with these two patients, and it was all negative. A lot of people try antihistamines because they look like urticaria, but ineffective. Though I will say that the antihistamine doses reported in here are pretty low. They used one of the newer ones. Well, something like cetirizine, I think, but it seemed to be just like single doses. And, you know, in our patients with chronic idiopathic urticaria, we often will do like four times the dose. So perhaps if you jacked it up, it would work. Mm-hmm. I use desloratadine. What else? So the condition may spontaneously resolve over months to years. And the authors of this paper say that you should consider screening patients for orthostatic intolerance even if they don't seem to have it, because one patient in literature had orthostatic intolerance like on tilt table testing, despite the fact that that patient was asymptomatic aside from the beer spots and so on. Honestly, I'm not sure if I agree. Like, if somebody's not symptomatic and not getting lightheaded when they stand up, then why bother, you know? Just if they happen to get orthostatic when they're on a tilt table, since that's not like a common thing you run into in real life. What do you think about that?
You know, that's a good question. Like, when is something an observed measurement? When does it actually become a disease? And usually with things like blood pressure or heart rate, we define that by symptomatology. I don't know if they're worried about like maybe risk for symptoms just because of the level of depression of blood pressure, but that is a good question.
They do point out that maybe the reason this shows up in newborns or adolescents is because the autonomic nervous system may undergo some changes around those times of overall physiologic change. They also wonder if the autonomic nervous system may change following an acute illness or other physical stressor. That's basically it for bascule syndrome. A few more tidbits about these beer spots.
Ooh, and I have a fun tidbit about Dr. Beer.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Okay, so Dr. Auguste Carl Gustave Beer, who was born in 1861 and died in 1949, was a German surgeon and named the beer spots after he kind of ran into them. He had previously performed the first operation under spinal anesthesia at the Royal Surgical Hospital in the University of Kiel, which is exciting. I looked him up because I was like, oh no, it's a German doctor. Dang it, is this person affiliated with the party that we have to keep changing names for? I can't find strong evidence that he was, so hopefully not. But
he was into a different kind of party, since he's Dr. Beer after all.
Oh, wait, oh no. He did receive the German National Prize for Art and Science, which was an award created by good old Adolf Hitler. Damn it. we may have to rename those. I don't know. So what was the other name for beer spots?
Aren't they called vasospastic macules?
That's what I thought. Yeah, vasospastic macules. We may have to, damn it. There was so much more fun to say beer spots.
All we know that he's gotten an award.
All we know is that he got an award.
From
and
Hitler.
He was, yes, that's, I mean, slightly damning that, but.
So they think beer spots show up due to some hypoxia. So if the blood is just pooling in your extremity, then it's not moving and you might get a little hypoxic. So maybe there's this vasoconstrictive exaggerated response. The authors posit that the urticaria-like wheals that evolve in vascular syndrome might also be sort of a reaction to hypoxia. Well, beer spots or vasospastic macules are usually just a benign physiologic phenomenon. They point out that they've been associated with a few other conditions like pregnancy and even during a renal crisis associated with scleroderma, systemic sclerosis.
Mm.
So there. Now I and our listeners know what vascular syndrome is. And whether it's hot right now or not will be, I suppose, for the public to decide.
Also, did you know that Dr. Beer named the beer block?
I didn't. Is that a nerve block?
Yes, it is. It's actually very funny. It's for the hand. He's kind of known as the father of spinal anesthesia, and the beer block is one of the techniques he developed. So in delving deeper into this, he retired from surgery in 1932, 1 year before the Nazis rose to power. And it says, although his signature appears, as do many of his colleagues, on a form in support of Adolf Hitler, he never made supportive statements for the Third Reich, so hard to say. And he passed away in a part of the German Empire called Sauen, I think? Not sure. Hard to tell. But the beer block and the beer spots named by Augustus Beer and hopefully he was not a Nazi.
We'll let it stand for now, though a beer block could also be a giant cube of ice with holes cut out for beer cans.
That is true. That is true. And one of my co-residents used to say, well, if you drink enough beer, isn't everything blocked? Ba-da-dum-bum-bum. All right. So terrible jokes aside, I would like to talk about something completely different. See, I did one of your segues because I couldn't find a good connection.
It's the Monty Python segue.
Exactly. So we're going to talk about one of the drugs that we do usually heart on this show because it has a very broad applicability and usually extremely significant improvement in patients' lives, quality of lives, and usually relatively minimal side effects. But there are some that we do need to be aware of. And so this is an article out of the Annals of Rheumatologic Disease. So we're branching out of our own subject species and going into others. And the article is entitled Dupilumab-Induced Enthesitis Arthritis in Patient with Atopic Dermatitis, a retrospective observational study. The authors are Dr. J. Nathan and L.B. Kirkham out of Guy and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust in the UK. Woohoo! So, this is
about dupilumab, and it's not a positive article.
I know. I mean, what will our robot overlords say? Just kidding. So this is an interesting article that points out the fact that they had observed some patients that had been treated with dupilumab that developed musculoskeletal adverse events, specifically enthesitis and arthritis, and they previously noticed it in 2019 in 3 patients. They point out rightfully that atopic dermatitis affects 2-10% of adults. It has relatively high prevalence. With that reason, IL-4 and IL-13 are known to play a key role in the pathogenesis, and dupilumab, which is a human IgG4 monoclonal antibody that binds the alpha subunit of the IL-4 receptor, blocks IL-4 and IL-13 signaling. So they had observed these 3 patients that had this enthesitis or arthritis in 2019, which they had reported. They decided to do ongoing observations at their center. So they looked between October 2018 and January 2021 and found about 400 adults with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis that had received at least one dose of dupilumab. Of those 400, 23 patients, they had 14 men and 9 women, and this is going to be important later. There's more men than women in this group, had clinical syndrome of inflammatory enthesitis, tenosynovitis, and arthritis. 9 of the patients had both enthesitis and arthritis, 10 had enthesitis, 3 had enthesitis and tenosynovitis, and 1 had arthritis only. 4 of these also reported new onset inflammatory back pain syndromes, and none had a preceding history of arthritis or enthesitis prior to starting the drug. The mean onset of symptoms following initiation of dupilumab was 4 months, but the symptom onset ranged from 2 weeks to 48 months. They actually did imaging in some of these patients to try to see if there was active inflammation. So they did ultrasound and MRI in 18 patients. 11 of those had Doppler ultrasound positive enthesitis, confirming their clinical findings. and the most common sites were the lateral epicondyles, the Achilles and patellar tendons. Two of the patients had more disabling symptoms, had also an MRI, which confirmed gluteus medius and hamstring enthesitis and arthritis. They had a spine and sacroiliac joint MRI in four patients, which was fortunately negative. And they found that most patients had normal inflammatory markers, with the exception of two patients who had elevated CRPs of 117 and of 13, and an ESR of 96 and of 10. So that one patient that had a CRP of 117 and 96 was quite the outlier. All the patients in this study had had very good response from their atopic dermatitis to the dupilumab, with their average EASI score decreasing from 21 before treatment to 4.2 after treatment. And remembering, EASI is sort of a measure of the severity of the disease and how it impacts the patient's life. So lower scores are better. One patient developed skin manifestations of guttate psoriasis and then developed disabling arthritis and enthesitis. But they point out, of course, that due to the life-changing benefit and effect of the dupilumab therapy, most of the patients wanted to continue therapy. So they used NSAIDs. Specifically, they used some of the coxibs, celecoxib, as well as naproxen for symptom relief, which was partially effective and allowed continuation of the dupilumab in most of the patients. Five patients who had severe musculoskeletal symptoms just stopped dupilumab completely. And some patients temporarily paused therapy but restarted when their atopic dermatitis flared, some of them changing down from dosing every 2 weeks to dosing every 4 weeks. Most of the patients who had musculoskeletal complaints continued the dupilumab. The four patients who stopped the dupilumab were then treated with baricitinib, a Janus kinase inhibitor, with potential efficacy for both the musculoskeletal symptoms as well as the atopic dermatitis. Two, unfortunately, didn't tolerate it and just remained on NSAID therapy. So this is, I think, an important signal that they're showing this new syndrome of enthesitis and or arthritis induced by dupilumab. They found in those with the mild musculoskeletal symptoms, NSAIDs allowed for continuation of full dose dupilumab in moderate cases, reducing the dose frequency to 4 weeks instead of every 2 weeks, improved things along with NSAID therapy. Most patients did have ongoing musculoskeletal syndrome. So unfortunately, unlike some of our medications where a side effect improves over time, like the GI side effects that you get with apremilast or Otezla, this seemed to be something that wasn't self-resolving. And in the more severe cases, they thought about Janus kinase inhibitor therapy as an effective strategy. So they do worry that there's inhibition of IL-4/13 by dupilumab might trigger an IL-17/23 TNF-mediated inflammatory musculoskeletal syndrome in some patients who are treated with dupilumab. One thing I thought about too, though, because it's a prevalence of men over women, and usually women win in autoimmune diseases, if you can call it winning, and the fact that the drug is an IgG4 molecule. Is there any way this could be related to IgG4 related disease, which is, as we know, kind of this nebulous but starting to sort of solidify and make sense set of symptoms that tends to occur in middle-aged patients, although it's also reported in children and young adults, where it favors men. So men are outnumbering women with the IgG4 related disease. It does involve inflammation of different organ systems and different glands, and the lacrimal glands are included in the glands that get inflamed with IgG4 related disease. We talked about an IgG4 related disease topic with Mikulicz disease in episode 28 and sort of some of the syndromes that could approach with that. Some patients have inflammatory arthritis with IgG4 related disease, such as RA or lupus. So it does make your eyebrows go up if you can raise your eyebrows. I can't really right now, too much Botox. But it does make you kind of ask some questions about potentially if that's one of the reasons why we see this, or is it this imbalance kind of tilting things towards more like the psoriasis axis. And the one patient that developed guttate type psoriasis lesions might also support that hypothesis. But I think it's very interesting. And of course, this kind of signal emerging is always something important to share with colleagues, because you may have, you know, a smaller center that doesn't have as much experience with the medication. And in your N of 30, you might have only one patient that has this. And you might think, well, that patient's just, you know, a hypochondriac, or this patient reacts to everything. But it might actually have some real kind of pathogenesis. What do you think?
Well, I want to shout out to my resident, Caitlin Bolander, who informed me of this article, because I have a little 12-year-old patient on dupilumab who was talking about how his knees and ankles were hurting since starting to play soccer. And I thought, well, it's probably just because you're playing soccer now. And I still think that's probably true. But she said, oh, have you heard about the enthesitis in dupilumab? So thanks, Caitlin. I know what arthritis is. Enthesitis, I always said, was like inflammation of where the tendon attached to the bone. So what's tenosynovitis?
I thought that was inflammation of like the tendon itself. like the tenosynovium. Okay. So like
Google can solve this problem.
So like the Quervain's tenosynovitis. So I definitely know that that can involve the tendons inflammation because that you have that sign that you check for the Quervain's tenosynovitis where you have a person make a fist with their thumb tucked in and then tilt their hand down. And if hurts at the medial part of the, I guess the radial side of the wrist, then that's a positive confirmatory sign. So I think that's what that means, but enlighten me per the Google.
Well, according to Google, tenosynovitis is inflammation of the tendon sheath where muscle connects to bone.
That makes sense.
And enthesitis is inflammation of the entheses, which are the insertion sites of tendons and ligaments to the bone. So that sounds pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're both where tendons and ligaments attach to bone. So maybe our rheumatologic colleagues will have to help split it apart for us.
I think that the sheaths occur in like different places than the attachment points. So it might also have to do with where the pain is localized.
Well, painful jointy things. Patients on dupilumab, start thinking about.
We're just going to call them PJTs. PJTs, painful jointy things.
So like this was about 6% of their 400 adults, by the way. So yeah.
It's not common, but you'll see it probably. No, but 6%
is also like not tiny either.
Yeah.
So pay attention, and my guess is that we're going to learn more about this as we move along. By the way, they did talk about how some of their patients switched to a JAK inhibitor for their atopic dermatitis, and in episode 59, we talked about upadacitinib for atopic dermatitis, if you want to learn more about that. If you want to learn more about Stevens-Johnson syndrome, then stick around, because that's what we're going to talk about next. So this is out of JAMA Dermatology. And it's called Long-Term Physical and Psychological Outcomes of Stevens-Johnson Syndrome / Toxic Epidermal Necrolysis. The authors include Melissa Hoffman is listed as first author, and Robert Micheletti is listed as the primary author, chief author? I forget what they're called. Senior author.
Corresponding? Okay.
And then some of our friends, Jesse Keller from OHSU and Arash Mastagimi, who has got another podcast, Topical, who... we appeared on his show once. He's on this too. The corresponding authors out of the University of Pennsylvania, but this was a multi-institute study. So this was a retrospective review of 121 adults who had Stevens-Johnson syndrome / toxic epidermal necrolysis from 11 academic centers overall. And the authors looked at sequelae, both physical and psychological, and discovered that the sequelae, both physical and psychological, are likely underappreciated. So, for example, the most common long-term physical sequelae were cutaneous problems in 84% of people, which is like the vast majority. So maybe that's scarring and dyspigmentation and things. Ocular problems in 60%. The eyeball, I don't really know what goes on in there. It's got chambers, it's got fluids, but they have problems, I guess, 60% of the time. And then oral mucosal problems in 51%. Again, maybe that's scarring or, you know, aphthae or something like that. In terms of psychological sequelae, 53% had depression on a depression screening tool called the PHQ-9. 43% had anxiety on an anxiety screening tool, the GAD-7. And 20% had results indicating PTSD on a PTSD screening tool. They said that, this is the most important to me, 28% of them were unable to work.
Oh, wow.
They didn't really say that it was because of the sequelae or they were able to work before, but now they're not. But still, that seems like a lot. By the way, the unemployment rate at the time when I looked at this in the U.S. was 6.3%. So 28% versus 6.3% is a lot. And wow. They say 68% of these people were fearful of taking new medications, which makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. But 30% of them avoided taking prescribed medicines for other conditions. So they might be so worried that they would get, you know, something like SJS that they don't want to take their medicines for things that presumably their medicines would help. By the way, moderate or worse depression in the general population is about 8%. So that's a lot less than the 25% of moderate or worse depression reported in this study. So once again, a total of 53% of these patients had some kind of depression reported, but a lot of those were mild. But 25% were moderate or worse. Again, that's compared to 8% of the general population in some random 2-week period. So those are all like specific time point thing, so a lot more. And by the way, lifetime PTSD prevalence is 8%. That's the real of the upshot here. The authors do say that the high rates of long-term physical and psychological complications of SJS-TEN necessitate multidisciplinary follow-up, meaning not just dermatologists and PCPs should follow these people. I do wonder how this compares to patients who are hospitalized with similarly severe issues. Like, maybe anytime you go into the ICU, you have these psychological effects. That would make sense to me. I wondered if just like anybody admitted to the ICU should have some kind of psychosocial follow-up by default. I wondered about this. And one of the cool things about going to medical school is you end up with a bunch of friends who then become doctors in different specialties. So you can sort of text and email your friends. So I've got one friend who runs a cardiac ICU, Zach, and I've got another friend who's a psychiatrist, Olga, and I emailed them and they said, well, you know, that actually makes some sense, but the mental health services in our country are already strained beyond belief, even more so with the COVID pandemic. So we probably just don't have the workforce to take care of these people. But in the hypothetical ideal situation, then maybe that would make sense.
I think that that's something to really think about when you're taking care of these patients. I've actually seen this in some patients as well that have recovered from SJS-TEN. The experience itself is so confronting, of course, because it's an ICU-type admission typically for these patients. And it's very claustrophobic inducing because often they're kind of confined to a bed and, you know, they have all of these dressings often stapled all over their body depending on how your center deals with those things. And it's quite a life-altering and paradigm-altering thing. So I agree that getting patients to take any new medications who've been through an episode of SJS-TEN is really challenging, and I can see why it would potentially cause some PTSD.
So from my perspective, if I have a patient who's had it, I would make sure I ask them about like eyeball stuff and mucous membrane stuff at follow-ups, just so I could potentially plug them in with ophthalmology and, you know, gynecology or whatever if necessary. And then if I sort of get a psychiatric vibe, I might ask them if they'd be interested in seeing somebody.
There's also interesting reports of people having eruptive nevi after recovering from SJS-TEN, and people also having difficulty with sweating that could be ameliorated through CO2 laser fractionated therapies. So all sorts of crazy stuff that can happen after that condition. It is its own unique animal.
Scary.
I know. So do you want to talk about something completely different?
Sure do.
I'm having trouble making connections today, but I do have some fun piece of history. So we're going to talk first now about the diagnostic kind of recourse and management of challenging erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp in a Greek population. And that made me wonder about the phrase, it's Greek to me. So if you've ever wondered where that comes from, do you know, Luke? You're kind of a literary person. You might know this.
I actually didn't know it had a specific origin. I just thought you meant I don't understand because I don't speak Greek.
Some people trace it to Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, came out apparently in 1599. And in this play, Casca is saying of a speech that was given by Cicero that had been deliberately given in Greek so that some people couldn't understand it. For mine own part, it was Greek to me. So he like couldn't understand it because it was in a language he didn't speak.
So all he said was, yep, I heard it. It was Greek.
And it's like, I can't understand it. Some people also think that it might be related to in the sort of middle ages where monks were trying to transcribe illuminated manuscripts that they might say to each other, it's in Greek and therefore it cannot be understood because they were dwindling in their ability to read and understand Greek just because it was kind of a war of attrition. But regardless, when we're talking about the cloudy and complicated condition that is erosive pustular dermatosis, it can also be somewhat nebulous and difficult to understand. So they endeavored to try to illuminate, like the manuscripts, some aspects of this particular condition. So this is an inflammatory dermatosis. It's characterized by the erosions, pustules, and crusts we've all come to know and not love so much in our poor elderly patients, usually who are handsome, like my chair. They have a little bit more of a androgenetic alopecia, and they might have some preceding trauma along with actinic damage, which my chair does not have because he is rigorous in his sun protection. So I appreciate that. They did a retrospective analysis of clinically and histologically diagnosed EPDS patients, and they wanted to look at the characteristics, efficacy of different treatments, as well as different associations. They analyzed all sorts of things, including their age, sex and smoking status, their alcohol consumption, and the presence or absence of photo damage, as well as relationship to non-melanoma skin cancer. They looked at their history from time to diagnosis, as well as their baseline visit and their treatment options. So interesting things that came forward from this. The great significant preponderance of patients in this study were between the ages of 66 and 85 years of age. And I think that that is consistent with what we see in our clinical practice. Of course, 92%-ish of them were men, and 83% of them were photodamaged. They looked at the Fitzpatrick phototype. Now, that is probably going to be something that varies regionally because they are in a Mediterranean area. So they had the highest preponderance of patients with type 3 in the Fitzpatrick scale, followed by type 2 skin and then type 4 skin, and zero patients with type 1 skin. I don't know that you'd survive for very long with type 1 skin in Greece. I think it's very, very sunny. Might be as hard as being in Lubbock, Texas with that type of skin.
Based on Mamma Mia, pretty much everybody's type 1 in Greece.
I think that that might be a little bit of what's it called? Whitewashing, potentially. I think that might be that. The interesting things to me as well were that alcohol consumption, they had patients that had, you know, heavy to low alcohol consumption with some representation of the disease, but 58% of their patients had no alcohol consumption at all. So I was like, is alcohol like protective against this in some weird way? That's an interesting question, probably for another study. The predominant location of the erosopustular dermatosis was on the vertex, and the surface area ranged kind of evenly between 0 to 10, 11 to 30, and greater than 30 centimeters. And the history of non-melanoma skin cancer in these patients was about 92%. So a lot of them had had skin cancer, the majority of them were sun damaged, and the vast majority of them were men. The treatments that they had used included topical steroids under occlusion, topical calcineurin inhibitors, often under occlusion as well, systemic retinoids, and a combination of all of those things. A cycle of topical steroids was defined as daily application for 2 weeks, followed by gradual de-escalation for 2 more weeks. They did follow-up visits every 4 weeks, and they did photography to allow for assessment of efficacy based off of the photographic assessment, which was nice. They also looked at the types of skin cancer that the patients experienced. The vast majority of them had had actinic keratoses, about 75%, and they had about 12% that had basal cells, about almost 40% that had squamous cell carcinoma, and they'd had several patients that had one or multiple non-melanoma skin cancers.
Squamous cell than basal cells.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Kind of a reverse of like the general population. I assume it's because of the actinic damage. Squams are more associated with significant sun exposure than basal cells.
I think probably that has to do also, like you're saying, with sort of chronic ongoing sun damage instead of episodic severe sun damage the way basal cells are. So, you know, people who live in a Mediterranean climate are exposed to it all of the time as opposed to people who vacation there occasionally and then go back to Cleveland or wherever the sun doesn't shine so much. I can say that because I was in residency there. So the other things that they brought forward were the types of therapies they had previously had for their different actinic keratoses and non-melanoma skin cancers. 70% of these patients had had cryotherapy. Almost 60% had had imiquimod. Photodynamic therapy, about 30% had had that. Inguinal mebutate, about 20% had had inguinal mebutate, and radiotherapy, about 16.7% had had radiotherapy. So all of these things kind of are thought of potentially as triggers for this condition, which I've always sort of thought of as an autoimmune reaction to your own actinic damage that gets stimulated after treatment of actinic keratoses. And the most common cited causative agent in most studies is cryotherapy, but that is also the modality that we use the most frequently. So that's one of the questions, is that something that is, you know, a prevalence issue, or is it really truly more risky? And then the photodynamic therapy is interesting because some patients actually have a therapeutic reaction to photodynamic therapy after they develop erosopustular dermatitis of the scalp, where they actually improve with photodynamic therapy, but in some patients it's also been cited as a potential triggering factor. They looked at 24 patients in the study, and we've kind of talked about their different characteristics. They had outcomes that they classified as complete response, partial response, which is a 30% or higher reduction in the affected area, progressive disease, which is 20% or higher increase of the affected area, and then stable disease. They talked about deterioration and recurrence as at least a 20% loss of previous partial or complete response subsequently at the follow-up visits. So of their 24 patients, at the first follow-up visit, 22 patients had been treated with topical steroids. Of those 22 patients, 14, which is about 64-ish%, showed a complete response with topical steroids. And about 31%, which was 7 of the patients, showed a partial response. One just had stable disease. The patient that received a topical calcineurin inhibitor also showed a partial response. So that's the good news. The bad news is after treatment cessation, 18 out of 23 of the patients, so almost 80%, 78.3%, experienced a recurrence or deterioration with a median time of 8 weeks. So the improvement occurred, but was not persistent. Recurrence and deterioration was managed with a couple of different regimens. They had either the option for a cycle of topical steroids with 25 milligrams of acitretin daily, and then acitretin continued after topical steroid withdrawal as a maintenance therapy. They had a cycle of topical steroids followed by topical calcineurins as a maintenance therapy. And then they had topical calcineurin inhibitors combined with 25 milligrams of acitretin that were both continued as maintenance therapy. And so they looked at these different groups and saw that recurrences were observed in 2 out of 9 patients that had the acitretin and 5 out of 7 patients that had topical calcineurin inhibitors as maintenance. So the patients that had maintenance therapy with acitretin had a longer lived improvement than patients who were only on topical calcineurin inhibitors, which makes sense. Acitretin is a relatively strong medication. To me, one of its biggest side effects is actually how expensive it is. And so I wondered if it was less expensive in Greece than it is in America. I looked to see that they have a medicine called neotigason. I'm not sure I'm saying that right, which is their version of acitretin. And that for a month's supply of 30 capsules of 25 milligrams a day, it would be about $65 a month. If you compare that to a month's supply of acitretin, which can range up to even like $1,000, that's a lot more affordable and a more realistic opportunity. The challenging thing about erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp is that there's no FDA indicated treatment for it either. So you can't get help from the, you know, patient assistance programs. You can't really strong arm a lot of insurance companies into covering something like acitretin for erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp. Although with exceptional effort, I feel like I've been able to a couple of times, but it is challenging. What's your experience, Luke?
Well, I'm a pediatric dermatologist, and this is something that happens to old people, so I don't see it very much. But I did see it in medical school, and I even wrote a little case report about it that never got published. But I like this article because it reminded me of erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp. So this is like ugly, pustular, crusty things on the scalps of old, sun-damaged white people. And it's difficult diagnostically because it kind of looks like actinic keratoses or squamous situ all over the place, which they could definitely have because they've got horrible sun damage. But if you treat it, and if it's an AK or an SCCIS, it just gets worse, right? Because trauma is thought to be a triggering factor. So first you got to diagnose it properly, and then you have to treat it properly, which is also challenging. So one other reason I like this article is because they laid out a decent treatment option. Try to clear it with something like clobetasol and then put people on acitretin. But as you say, sometimes acitretin is expensive or hard to get. Acitretin, of course, is a systemic retinoid. So I wonder if there's any data behind isotretinoin or Accutane with this condition, which is usually a lot easier to get.
That's a really good question. And I think that also one nice thing about having this kind of thing published in our literature is that we can potentially use that to argue with insurance companies about whether or not a medication should be covered. And they did point out, and I'm glad you brought up, the fact that there's often a delay to diagnosis with this condition because it can mimic a lot of other things and it's often diagnostically challenging. It overlaps with non-melanoma skin cancer. It can overlap with infections of bacteria or fungi or bullous dermatoses. It can also potentially overlap with inflammatory alopecias like folliculitis decalvans. They also note that, like you said, treatment for the topical non-melanoma skin cancer, if one misinterprets it as that, can continue to worsen the condition. And if you biopsy it, trying to get some help from the pathologist, you have to make sure you have a pathologist who understands this condition and that you've given them the ability to know that's what you're looking for. Because a biopsy of erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp is going to show actinic damage. It's going to show keratinocytes that are misbehaving. But there also is this sort of overabundance of neutrophilic inflammation, which you can sometimes incidentally see. But in the setting of a person asking, is this erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp, might be an important sign that you can help to guide the therapeutic options with. They also talk about the sort of topical destructive therapies that some people might go after these with if you believe that or you misinterpret it as continued actinic damage as a vicious circle of inflammation-impaired healing. And I think inflammation-impaired healing is something that we don't think about enough, where patients can't heal because the inflammatory system is just getting in the way of the skin trying to heal. They also talk about the fact that, you know, while you treat patients with topical steroids, they will improve, but you can't consider them ad nauseum because they can cause skin atrophy, and that could eventually worsen the ability of the integrity of the skin to maintain coverage over the scalp and the calvarium. They also talk about the fact that in this paper, both systemic retinoids and topical calcineurin inhibitors were beneficial, but the systemic retinoids were more likely to lead to improvement than the topical calcineurin inhibitors. I think good food for thought. And, you know, we maybe have food for thought in a Greek salad. How about that?
I like it. All right. I'm tired of talking about old people. Let's talk about little kids.
Okay.
So this is an article out of BMC Infectious Diseases, and it's called A Clinical Scoring System for Pediatric Hand-Foot-Mouth Disease. The authors include Hui Huang, Li Deng, and Runan Zhu out of China. So they created a scoring system for hand-foot-mouth disease. So, you know, I often don't think of hand, foot, and mouth disease as that difficult to diagnose clinically, but there are these sort of atypical forms or non-standard forms that look a bit different. And then I think they primarily developed this with not for dermatologists specifically, but maybe for PCPs out in rural China to try to figure out if this is really hand, foot, and mouth disease or not. And, you know, if you know it's hand, foot, and mouth disease, then you know it's, you know, about how communicable it is and what to tell people and so on, even though there's not really a treatment for it. So they got 1,400 patients, all under 3 years, so little kids, who had possible hand, foot, and mouth disease. They all got tested, and about 1,000 of them actually had it on testing. So 1,000 people with it, 400 people who kind of looked like they could have it but didn't. And the authors used science.
Science!
Actually, they used math to test 15 variables.
Math.
And those most helpful in the, you know, logistic regression, et cetera, hand wave. I mean, there's statisticians out there who know this stuff. I am not one of them, but I trust them. So the variables that were most helpful in figuring out if something was truly hand, foot, and mouth disease or a mimic were age, exposure history, and rash density at some specific regions of the body. And the way this math created the system is that scores range from -5 to 24. And they decided that a cutoff score of 7 seemed to be the best. It resulted in a sensitivity of 76% and a specificity of 68%, which is not like super awesome, but maybe decent enough. So what's the system that they came up with? I'm glad you asked in your head. So let's see. You can, of course, access this article and take a look. There's a nice table here, but age, they say for each additional 1 year of age, you get a point. But remember, these kids were no older than three, so we could get up to only 2 or 3 points there. An exposure history. So an exposure history was defined as close contact with individuals with confirmed hand, foot, and mouth disease or herpetic angina no more than 10 days prior to onset. If you had that, you got 7 points.
Okay.
Which is the highest. So remember, 7 is like the cutoff of saying, okay, the sensitivity and specificity really suggest that you could have hand, foot, and mouth disease. And then there was what they referred to as rash count on 5 different parts of the body that were all worth varying points. So 3 of them were in the oropharynx and 2 of them were on the body. So hard palate, soft palate, and buccal mucosa. If you looked and you counted the number of spots in all of those places, you either had few or you had many. So many was 4 or more and few was less than 4. And those are worth varying amounts of points, like 3 points or 2 points or 4 points. You can look it up here. And then on the back and the buttocks, many was 6 lesions or more, whereas few was fewer than 6. So a little bit different on the skin as opposed to the oropharynx. And the interesting thing is that if you had it on the butt, if you had many lesions on the butt, so 6 or more, then you got 5 points. And I have often in my head thought that hand, foot, and mouth disease should be renamed hand, foot, mouth, butt disease, because I often see the rash on the butt. But interestingly, it doesn't really show up on the back. In fact, if you have many lesions on the back, you got -5 points. So having spots on the back means it's less likely that the patient actually has hand, foot, and mouth disease and probably has something else instead. That was interesting. They point out that hand, foot, and mouth disease is caused by enteroviruses. This might be bell-worthy. So that sound is the pimping bell, meaning this is a good testable question or a good pimping question. So enteroviruses such as enterovirus 71 and coxsackievirus A1, which cause, quote, typical hand, foot, and mouth disease, where, of course, we see them on the palms and soles, these, quote, deep-seated vesicles, they get it in the mouth and so on. They say most of the kids in this study actually had other viral etiologies besides enterovirus 71 and Coxsackie A1. Mostly they had other Coxsackie viruses, which usually cause atypical hand, foot, and mouth disease. So this scoring system might be especially good for the atypical version of hand, foot, and mouth disease. They do point out that one limitation of the study is that they have not tested the scoring system in different cohorts at different institutions. But still, the scoring system is now out there in the world. So especially if you're, you know, teaching perhaps rural PCPs or something, you might bring it out. I thought the most important thing for me was this rash on the back thing. I probably would have come to a similar conclusion if I had thought about it hard enough, but I'm not sure I would have come to that conclusion sort of in the heat of the moment. So if somebody has a bunch of spots on the back, really think about whether or not it's truly hand, foot, and mouth disease or back disease instead.
I like that. Back disease by itself. Back to the future. I love it. So let's see if I can make some kind of connection. You know, some movies that I love that are considered classics now. One of them, of course, Back to the Future. Another one, Welcome to Thunderdome. Let's talk about a cage match. So we
never heard of Thunderdome.
Mad Max, right? Isn't that like Mad Max? Mad with like Max. Mel Gibson?
Have seen it. I did not like it, even though it seems like the kind of movie I would like.
Because they have this metal cage they fight in, right?
I feel like
that's a thing that happens. Can you Google
that?
I know they did that in
Spider-Man.
I'm super bad at this. Okay. So anyway,
Good segue.
Yeah, so thank you. So what I'm trying inelegantly to present here is sort of an academic cage match of sorts, where the cage is comprised of tattoo needles and microneedles, because we have a lovely discourse between the authors of a paper we've reviewed previously discussing microneedling of platelet-rich plasma versus topical insulin, and an author who is proponing that the tattoo needles would be more efficacious and would like to see different studies done with the microneedles. So I love academic cage matches because scientists fight, and when scientists fight and they fight ethically and when they fight with each other on the basis of fact, we actually end up with science winning. And I love it when science wins. So we have first our article here, which is a response to microneedling with autologous platelet-rich plasma versus microneedling with topical insulin in the treatment of post-acne atrophic scars, a simultaneously performed split face comparative study.
And we mentioned that, I'm sorry, you were just about to say it. We discussed it in episode 52.
52!
And the issue was that these authors put insulin on one side of the face before microneedling it and platelet-rich plasma on the other side before microneedling it and found that the insulin performed better. And you actually said that you went out and just bought some insulin at a pharmacy and have done it with some of your own patients.
Yes, I have actually tried it on a couple of patients. I tried it, of course, as many good scientists self-experiment. I tried it on myself first to make sure it didn't make me feel strange and I didn't have any weird side effects or irritation from it. And then, of course, I had my twin sister handy, so I don't know if that's quite as ethical. But I also did a little treatment for her and she thought it worked beautifully. So I've been able to try that in several patients and I do feel like it performs better than treating without the topical insulin. Now, I'm not just using it with microneedling. I'm also using it with CO2 laser in a fractionated setting. And I have a little scar on my nose from having a dermoid cyst removed that has been very persistent despite my best efforts to efface it. And I've seen better improvement using the topical insulin after the CO2 laser than I had seen previously with that treatment. So digression aside here, this is the article, The Response, by Dr. Soha Ghanian and friend of the show, Carlos Wambier. And so they wanted to look at some thoughts that they had about this article when they read it. I always love how these start. So Dr. Pawar and Dr. Singh presented interesting findings from a split-face study of microneedling followed by either topical platelet-rich plasma or topical fast-acting insulin. Now, I do think the followed by part of that might be slightly different than how it was phrased in the original paper, because I think that they were actually microneedling through either platelet-rich plasma or topical insulin. I think Luke is going to check on that for me. So they were using the ACTRAPID human insulin on the treatment of these post-acne scars. That study had concluded that microneedling with topical insulin, or PRP, was associated with a statistically significant better improvement in the post-acne scarring that had the atrophic appearance. And they were concerned about the study design and wanted to provide some guidance for future interventional studies and think about the mechanisms of the actions of topical agents. They agreed with some things actually that we said when we were looking at the article, that it would have been nice to have a control group that didn't have either PRP or insulin, that just had like saline or another inert topical to kind of really assess for the improvement over the baseline efficacy of the therapy by itself. So they used PRP in the study as sort of the, I guess they were looking for a non-inferiority type of thing almost, and they proved like actually some superiority, which is nice. It is there's a little kind of fly in the ointment with the design of studies. If you design a study as a non-inferiority study, even if you show superiority, you can't claim superiority. So I don't know that that's exactly how it was, how they designed that study, but it was sort of in a similar thought process that they were going after the gold standard and seeing if they could do better than that. So they thought a control group of microneedling alone would be better. And they also talked about the fact that split phase studies are more informative with side randomization and that there might be problems with laterality bias. We talked about that too, the potential for if you drive on one side of the car versus the other side of the car, the side that gets some more sunlight through the driver's side window may have a decreased response or less impressive response because of that chronic photodermatitis, depending on the side that the vehicle steering wheel is on. So we talked about that as well. And I do think it would have been a stronger study had there been side randomization to allow for
the... Instead, they just put insulin on the right side of the face for everybody and PRP on the left side for everybody.
And then the authors made a very interesting point that I hadn't personally thought about, that you might get a more vigorous procedure on the side of the face depending on the dominant hand of the clinician. So that's something that I had not previously considered, but something to think about, and also something for me to personally think about when I'm performing cosmetic procedures to make sure that I'm optimizing treatment on both sides of the face, regardless of my own limited handedness, so that I can ensure giving an even treatment to the patient. They also are concerned that protein-rich preparations may not penetrate through the microchannels created by microneedling properly. So they thought about mechanism of action, topical preparations, growth factors. They worry about those having the ability to achieve dermal delivery after microneedling. They kind of cite and refer to a study where they'd had a kind of passive microneedling and then had rubbed black ink to the skin and gotten histopathology to look for dermal delivery and were only able to find it in the stratum corneum. They also talked about the possibility of topical penetration beyond the corneal layer not occurring with large molecules. Anything larger than 500 Daltons, and insulin is over 5,000 Daltons, so it's a large molecule and might prevent dermal absorption in their concern. And then they also talk about the kind of needling technique that has been developed over eons to intentionally deliver liquids and pigments to the dermis with a tattooing technique might be more efficacious. And this is a particular area of interest for Dr. Wambier, and I know he's got some great data behind how it works for his patients and the technology that he's used it for to kind of use tattooing technique. He goes a little bit into the physics of how this all works. So dermal negative pressure can kind of suck the fluids down into the dermis, sort of capillary action style. I think that there was a technique developed initially in the burn literature where they were treating patients that had hypertrophic and restrictive burn scars and found that after CO2 treatment to the scars, if they put topical liquid Kenlog and 40 milligrams per milliliter on top of the fractionated CO2 wounds, that the medicine seemed to end up in the skin and actually thin and decrease the thickness of the scar. So I think that that's sort of that same dermal negative pressure or capillary action. And he relates this also to the hydrodynamics of venom inoculation during snake bites. And I love that there is actually a citation here for a paper from the kind of literature about reptiles. So tears of venom, hydroxamines of reptilian envenomation in a derm paper. So I thought that was super fun that was in there. So that's kind of the way that when a snake bites you, the venom gets into the skin. And so he talked about when dry needles are used during microneedling, after procedure pressure gradient doesn't allow dermal delivery of liquids to previously made injury columns. And that when they're exposed to normal air pressure, pinpoint bleeding would, you know, if you had that kind of process, pinpoint bleeding could flow back from the epidermis to the dermis. There's a question that I have about whether or not we're thinking about the same thing, though. I want to make sure that we're all thinking about how people are utilizing this technology. So when I do the microneedling or the CO2 laser treatments, I do them in a sort of different fashion based off the technology. So with the microneedling, I actually put whatever liquid I'm using as a lubricant on the skin first. So I don't dry microneedle the liquids right there on the surface of the skin. Now, I know that in previous discussions, Dr. Wambier has talked about the fact that that could splash back with the needles, and that is certainly a possibility. I think that we are still learning as much as we can about these different tools, and I think that the, you know, improved efficacy of delivery of the drug to the dermis with tattooing is probably not an arguable point. You definitely can deliver the medication to the dermis more effectively with tattoo needles. They're quite well designed to do that. I look forward to a day where we have derm-specific tattoo devices and sterile drugs of all types to help improve our patients' cutaneous conditions. I think other interesting reference here is talking about the possibility of you know, maybe doing more studies on this, utilizing the sham controlled studies, using the side randomization, and then maybe even comparing it to tattoo related drug delivery. So that was article number one. Did you have any thoughts about that one, Dr. Johnson?
Well, it's interesting that he says, you know, if the dermis could actually sort of suck in whatever you're putting over the top of it after you microneedle it, then it would just suck the blood back in too. But we actually see like blood coming out, which is, I mean, that kind of makes sense to me. But as we'll learn in the next article, there's studies that just say it works. So that even though that makes sense, if you actually microneedle and then put something over the top, it does seem to get into the dermis or have improved outcomes, apparently, for some reason.
Well, and I really do appreciate when authors kind of considerately and thoughtfully have a discourse with each other about the merits of the theory, as well as the veracity and well, not veracity, because I think everybody's being honest and truthful, but the vigorousness of the results and how they can be replicated and potentially improved upon. And I think that's important so that concepts like the ptotic kidney discussion that went on in nephrology for decades, where people thought you had to resuspend kidneys that had become sort of ptotic in the abdomen of children, or they'd get UTIs, and that was done for a period of time. You know,
right.
Until that was
everybody
really...
knows the famous ptotic kidney discussions. How can you not?
But, you know, if that kind of paradigm isn't challenged, then we might be doing futile care or, you know, harmful care in one way or another. Now, I don't think that this microneedling could be harmful in any way, but perhaps it could be improved. And certainly rigorously defined studies help us to improve our knowledge broadly. And so I'm
By
also...
By the way, the original study was dry microneedling and then insulin over
top. Okay. So I do it a little bit differently than the way that they do it in the study. So that's good to know. So thank you for clarifying that. And thank you for bringing that to our attention, Dr. Wambier. So this is now the reply to comments on microneedling with autologous platelet-rich plasma versus microneedling with topical insulin and the treatment of post-acne atrophic scars with a split-face study. And so this was July of 2021. The previous response was in May of 2021. And the authors, as is common and appropriate with this, very courteously respond that we read with admiration the comments by Wambier et al. Treatment with platelet-rich plasma is an already established proven modality for post-acne scarring, so we sought of comparing the microneedling of topical insulin with the benchmark therapy. So they went after the gold standard, and I think that that is actually a very admirable thing to do. They talked about having already admitted the shortcomings of the study in the penultimate paragraph, and I love that they use the word penultimate. I think that's a great word. So the paragraph
next to last.
Right before the last paragraph, saying the lack of separate assessment of each treatment modality was a weakness of the study. And they agreed that the idea of side randomization could improve things. They maintained uniformity by having the protocol the same in all patients. They do disagree with the statement that topical application of protein preparations or growth factors cannot achieve dermal delivery after microneedling. There is a study that Dr. Wambier quoted about that. They have a combating study, which, you know, I love it when science battles with itself, because in the end, we all get better understanding and we all win. So there's, you know, possible studies that they have that can show that there have been meta-analyses and randomized controlled trials where they've been able to demonstrate the efficacy of PRP on post-acne atrophic scarring with histological evaluation, as well as confirming dermal delivery of growth factors after microneedling. And I think that this is a topic that needs further research, but I'm excited that they're kind of debating this, because that sort of elevates the level of discussion and brings more interest to the field. The stratum corneum itself is impermeable to drugs larger than 500 Daltons. Microneedling can potentially overcome this hindrance. In some studies, it has been shown to potentially enhance transdermal delivery of drugs in different pharmacological categories. And the other interesting point they bring forward is that transdermal delivery of insulin is being studied actually as an alternative to subcutaneous injection for managing diabetes. And it's one of the most studied modalities for kind of reversible skin microchannels to improve skin permeability and allow delivery of insulin. So they were interested about that. They also, it's cute, they talk about mission accomplished versus mission impossible. So one of the articles cited by Wambier et al., I'm sorry, I should say by Ghanian and Wambier, was actually entitled, let's see, where was that? Drug delivery, yeah.
Mission impossible,
dermal delivery of growth factors via microneedling. So there was a study that they cited in Dermatologic Therapeutics from 2019. And then here in this sort of reply, it says it's already mission accomplished that you can deliver drugs dermally through microneedles and microchannels. They did definitely agree that there are opportunities for further research, and they're excited about that. They talked about a study in which authors used confocal laser scanning microscopy and were able to demonstrate that microneedling enhanced delivery of cosmeceutically relevant peptides to the skin. And that was in a publication that they have in their citations here, yep, which was a microneedle enhanced delivery of cosmeceutically relevant peptides in human skin. Very exciting. So that's a article I'm excited to read next. They tip their hat a little bit to the fact that they don't have the experience of using tattoo technique and therefore can't comment on its efficacy with topical PRP, but they would like to try drug tattooing. I love that spirit of enthusiasm and openness to evaluate the results histologically with the microneedling technique in the future. So I envision in the future a real cage match between tattoo needles and microneedles, and we can kind of put them head to head as it were and see if we can't enhance and improve our understanding of both treatment modalities and how to maximize them for patient benefit.
So is the tattooing device different because like the needles are hollow and contain the drug or whatever inside them and are sort of injected into the dermis?
That's what I understand about that. I'm actually so interested in this. I've been looking on tattoo like techniques or new technicians classes. Like I'm sort of intrigued and I almost want to take a class and learn how to do tattoos so that I can understand the technology a little bit better. I'm fascinated by the idea of tattoo-assisted drug delivery. And Dr. Wambier has some amazing cases where he's done tattoo-assisted drug delivery for different modalities of therapeutics for hair loss and things like that that have shown some pretty impressive results. So I don't doubt that that is a usable technology. Our limiting factor is finding sterile solutions that we can use for the medications we're trying to deliver. And that's one attractive thing about the insulin is that it is already sterile. Like it's already made and intended to be injected into human skin. And so that might be a ready-made option for, you know, a head-to-head trial, as it were. Now, the original authors of the PRP and insulin microneedling were very careful about making sure that they didn't have any adverse side effects related to hypoglycemia or potential systemic insulin absorption. And I think you'd have to be as careful or even more so with tattoo needles as you might have increased delivery of the drug to the dermis. But I'm fascinated with the opportunities for improvement, and I'm excited always when there's this type of discourse.
Dr. Carlos Wambier has joined us as a guest in a bonus episode, by the way, released in July of 2020, entitled COVID, Androgens, Alopecia, and Sunlight. And I hope I'm not mischaracterizing him, but he seems to enjoy challenging people. So we also discussed one of his articles in episode 34 that syringes might contain silicone oil, which could have been responsible for a presentation in a different article. So we thought maybe there should be an occasional recurring segment on this show called In the Cage with Carlos.
I think it would be amazing. I'll write a theme song. It's going to be amazing.
Well, that's all we have time for today. So today we learned about bascule syndrome, beer anemic spots, cyanosis, and urticaria-like eruption that shows up on standing. We learned that perhaps dupilumab can somehow be involved with enthesitis arthritis and tenosynovitis, though we still don't know what all of those are. We learned that people with SJS, after they get out, they still have some sequelae, physical as well as psychological, so pay attention. We're going to learn about erosive pustular dermatosis of the scalp. If you diagnose it correctly, it's treatable with topical steroids, but then people might need something like a systemic retinoid in order to stay clear. We learned about a scoring system for hand, foot, mouth, butt disease, and that if you've got lesions on the back, maybe think about a different diagnosis. And we revisited our microneedling with insulin article that we discussed some time ago, saying, well, maybe there's some shortcomings to the study. Maybe these large molecules can't be sucked in into the holes. But on the other hand, maybe they can. But we're all interested in getting a tattoo.
In the cage with Carlos. Brr-dow!
Thanks to everybody for hanging out with us today. Thanks to Ryan Carlisle, medical student and member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps our social media accounts buzzing along. By the way, he's applying this year, so look kindly on his application, please. And Thanks to our institutions, thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. If you would like to listen to more Dermasphere, you can do so on any of our or any of your podcast apps, such as Apple Podcasts and wherever else. You can also find our entire archive on our website, dermaspherepodcast.com, which is also a good way to get in touch with us, and hopefully we'll be featuring that unboxing video that I discussed earlier. Also, Michelle, you and I recently started another podcast.
We did, because we didn't have enough to do.
Do you want to tell our listeners about this one?
Sure. So we have our new podcast, which is more public facing. It's called Skincast, and it is oriented towards lay people that want to learn more about how to take the very best care of their skin. So it has an alternating weekly production schedule to Dermasphere. So it comes out on the weeks that Dermasphere isn't dropping a new episode. And it's been a lot of fun to record. We've tried to make some good educational podcasts. It's much shorter. It's about 15 to 20 minutes and designed for a lay audience.
Yeah, so check that one out if you're interested. Otherwise, we will see you back here in the Dermasphere in 2 weeks.